murder mystery aficionados here? Few? Yeah? Okay. I suspect you love suspense. That's why you love mystery. It's why you'll read 600 pages just to find out what happens on the last page. Guess what? You can turn to the last page before you start the book, and there you go. It's done. Save yourself some time. But what makes a murder mystery is the mystery part, right? I did pass English, so I realize that's not very profound. But as we move through Lent, and we are on week 3 of Lent, this last week of Jesus' life before his crucifixion, that's the journey of Lent. The suspense builds. The intrigue builds. And we miss this in the text often if we're just reading through, because the gospel writers, those who wrote down the account of Jesus' life, were very frugal with their words. They weren't writing a mystery novel for our entertainment. They were recounting events. And they picked and chose the events because they were conveying something about Jesus, something about God, something theological. And so it's kind of up to us to put ourselves in the story, to engage our imaginations and to experience the events, to feel the feels and smell the smells and hear the yells. That's our exercise in Lent. It's actually our exercise every time we come to the text, but never more so maybe than at this time in the calendar during Lent as we head towards Easter and the crucifixion. Lent isn't just 6 weeks of restraint and abstaining from something, although that's not a bad thing, that can be really helpful, but it's about inhabiting the story, interrogating the witnesses, the accomplices, interrogating the context, what's going on here, really, interrogating ourselves. It's a season of truth-telling, of exposing our own blind spots. That's what the text does. It holds up a mirror. It challenges the assumptions we hold about Jesus, about the Jesus way, about our own following of Jesus. We know this when we're driving. We know how dangerous a blind spot can be. We don't look over our shoulder. We don't check the blind spot. Didn't see the cyclist, right? Can be catastrophic. In Jesus' following, it's the same. Oops, we might miss seeing how our faith has been co-opted by our culture and by media and by self-serving religious agendas, by those who twist and weaponize Scripture to achieve their own ends, who justify the means by the end. Well, look at that. Jesus looks just like me. Jesus thinks like I do. Jesus votes like I do. Jesus likes and dislikes the same people I do. Those can be the blind spots of faith, and they are catastrophic. Theology, what we think about God, matters. It matters a lot, and we see it being played out in Technicolor on our media screens today. We see it played out tragically throughout history. Blind spots are dangerous. And as this intrigue builds throughout this last week of Jesus' life, we're looking at Judas. Judas the betrayer. That's how he's known. That's how he's remembered. That's his eulogy. Judas the betrayer. We've sort of reduced Judas's life down to that one word, the betrayer. We've written him off as a one-dimensional character, as a bad actor. And when we do that, he becomes unrelatable. We can't relate to Judas. You might think this sermon's not for you. Maybe Judas and I have nothing in common. I have no intentions of ever betraying Jesus. Here's the thing. I don't think Judas did either. I think Judas's blind spot was tragic, and I suspect Judas didn't realize what he was doing. In fact, the evidence in the text would demonstrate that he actually didn't realize what he was doing. So I suspect we may have a lot more in common with Judas than we might think or might want to think. And so just starting with a bit of background before we get to Judas in the text today, it's the same background as last week. This takes place right after the event that we looked at last week, and we're looking at Mark 14, verse 1. It was just 2 days before the Passover and the festival of unleavened bread. The chief priests and the other scribes were looking for a way. Looking for a way, that is the Greek word zitzain. And it means seeking to gain control over. There's a desperation in this verb. Looking for a way to arrest Jesus by stealth. We see that word stealth, there's a sleaziness there. There's conspiracy there. There's scheming. There's something going on in the background. They're looking for a way to kill him. For they said, not during the festival, or there may be a riot among the people. So these chief priests, these elders, these are religious elites. They're wringing their hands at this point. They want Jesus gone. He is a nuisance. He is an annoyance. He's so popular. He's a celebrity. And Jerusalem, remember, it's the Passover. It's packed with people. The population's 5 times what it normally is. So this gives Jesus such an opportunity to gain a greater following. This gives Jesus an enormous platform to expose the corruption within the religious system. But their hands are tied. They can't risk a riot with Rome, or Rome will unleash their fury. It's kind of the soundtrack that's playing behind the text that we're looking at today. So the stage is set for deception, for conspiracy, for scheming. And then, as we saw last week, there's this scene with this unnamed woman who comes in and she outshines the inner circle of male disciples with her devotion, her utter, radical, reckless devotion of this gift of expensive perfume that she pours over Jesus. She believes Jesus when he says he's going to die. And it's contrasted with their disbelief. Her humble devotion is contrasted with their quest, their obsession with power. You can find that on our website or on our YouTube channel if you want to catch up with that. But right after that, right after this beautiful scene that just takes place, look at what we read in the text, picking up at verse 10 of Mark 14. Then, right after that, Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, that's the title Mark uses for Judas throughout his gospel. Over and over and over again, Judas, one of the 12, he's using that title to make a point. He went to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. When did he go? When he realized that Jesus was serious about his impending death, when he realized that Jesus was not the prize fighter out for blood that he had hoped for, but he was actually willing to shed his own blood, when he realized that Jesus wasn't going to overthrow Rome, he wasn't going to gain power, when he realized there'd be no glory for himself or for Israel, when his expectations were dashed, when his theology was disputed and upended, and the rug was pulled right out from under him. Maybe you've been there. Maybe you're there now, where the beliefs that you've held for so long now kind of seem incongruent with the Jesus that you're encountering, the Jesus that you're learning about, the givens of your faith. Maybe now you're not so sure about. And it's a painful place to be for any of us who have been through that. There's nothing sexy or deliciously rebellious about it. It's just hard when our certainties are shaken. But certainty, friends, is no friend of faith. Certainty is the opposite of faith. And so here at Lakeside, we welcome questions. We welcome wrestling with the tensions of life and faith and Scripture and God. This decision to kill Jesus was an official decision by the religious establishment. This was not a popular choice. The people loved Jesus. The religious establishment, those who policed the rules of faith, who controlled the temple, who decided who was in and who was out. Today, that could be denominations, it could be the Vatican, it could be whoever claims to hold the keys of orthodoxy. In first century Israel, they were the ones who held the keys, the religious scribes and temple elites. And they benefited from empire. They cozied up to Rome. Their existence depended on the empire, on being pleasing to the empire. And Jesus got in the way of that agenda. He exposed the rot that was within. So the decision to silence Jesus came after he had challenged the corruption within the religious establishment, after he'd flipped their tables of greed and exposed their system. You see, institutions and traditions and organizations don't tolerate whistleblowers well. Jesus was a whistleblower. Those who expose the corruption within a system are resisted. They're silenced. In Jesus' case, eliminated. You may have experienced that. Maybe you asked questions about beliefs. You were curious, you were unsure, you were doubting, and all of a sudden you were shamed about your faith. Maybe you challenged church leadership and you were told you were a troublemaker. Or maybe you reported abuse. You're finding yourself at the tip of the spear of weaponized scripture, told it was your fault, told you should really forgive. That would be the thing to do. You see, challenging the status quo is always risky. It cost Jesus his life. If that is you, if you're still carrying that pain and that hurt from that, I'd love to have a conversation with you about that. Our prayer team that's up here after, they would love to pray with you through that. Church hurt is painful hurt. Finally, on this day, hearing Jesus speak of his imminent death was too much. It was the last straw for Judas. He realized Jesus wasn't the kind of liberator that he'd signed up for. The Jesus he wanted was not the Jesus he had. The battles he wanted Jesus to fight were not the battles Jesus was there to fight. And he figured Jesus squandered the opportunity he had during the parade of palms on the Sunday before, where the crowds were cheering for him. He had them eating out of his hand. That would have been the time for a rousing political speech. That would have been the time for miraculous theatrics and just to rile the crowd up to revolt. That was his opportunity. And Jesus, in Judas's eyes, missed it. He had them eating out of his hand and he let it all go. Instead, what did Jesus do? He wept. He wept. And then he confronted the temple elites and then he said he was going to die. How defeatist is that? Who wants a leader who acknowledges defeat before defeat? Doesn't inspire confidence. It wasn't motivating. If Jesus wanted to forgive enemies and hang out with those on the margins, be in solidarity with the marginalized, die at the hands of a pagan empire without even a fight, that was not the liberator Judas had signed up for. He was not going to support and follow that kind of a liberator. Judas had Jesus all wrong. Judas had the wrong Jesus. One New Testament scholar writes, Judas had been ready to commit his life to holy war. Jesus turned out to be a charlatan for that cause, and Judas took revenge on him for causing his disappointment. So Judas offers Jesus up. And here's what we read in verse 11. They, that's the religious establishment, were delighted when they heard why he had come, and they promised to give him money. So he began looking for an opportunity to betray Jesus. These religious rulers, that's who they were, must have thought, this is a gift from God. I mean, look at the timing. Just when we'd hit a wall, God came through. This must be God's will. Everything's lining up. It's a sign that God is on our side. Looking back on it, we want to scream, check your blind spot. You're missing it. How can you be so foolish and so blind? They had the scriptures that told them all about God. But they created a God so much in their own image, with their own desires and their own agendas, that when God showed up, they missed God. Blind spots, friends, can be catastrophic. The gospel writers don't actually give us a clear reason as to why Judas betrayed Jesus. We can speculate. There's some evidence that can be quite compelling. Some say it was greed, but that's not a very strong argument. He was already the treasurer for the disciples. He had access to the purse. We're told he'd helped himself already numerous times. Mark doesn't even tell us how much they gave Judas. It wasn't until Matthew wrote his gospel that he told us they gave him 30 pieces of silver. He offers up Jesus before the promise of money. Judas is the only seller of a prized possession, a prized commodity. He could have set his price. He could have auctioned Jesus off to the highest bidder. If this were a business project, he would have failed miserably. He doesn't even haggle, which in their culture, does what you do. You don't settle for the price you're offered. And the offer is a joke. It's about $300 today. What's that worth? A week's of Starbucks lattes, maybe? Trip to the movies with your family without the popcorn? Marilyn Monroe's happy birthday dress sold for $4.8 million. Taylor Swift comes in at a low $2,500 for her red carpet outfit. So if it's greed, he's a really lousy negotiator. So was it greed or was it something else? Probably be easier to write off if it was greed. Some scholars suggest that his last name, Iscariot, is a clue to the mystery. You see, Iscariot could be a distortion of the Latin word sicarius, which means murderer or assassin. And the Sicarii were a very radical splinter group from another radical violent group called the Zealots. So it'd be like a splinter group from ISIS, because ISIS isn't violent enough. That was the Sicarii. They were highly trained guerrillas. They used terrorism and assassinations and kidnappings in order to terrorize Rome, to resist Roman occupation. They used daggers much like this. They concealed them. They were called sica. They'd conceal them in their cloaks, and then they'd kill the Romans or any Roman collaborators when they were in crowded spaces, and they could just get the job done and slip away unnoticed. They would kill with stealth. Their MO was, if we can't topple you, Rome, then we're going to terrorize you. We're going to make it as costly for you to rule us as we can. If Judas came from this sect, then he saw the potential in Jesus, right? The fearlessness Jesus had in challenging the authorities and confronting the religious establishment who were in bed with the Romans. He figured maybe we could leverage Jesus' miraculous powers to heal and to feed thousands with a kid's Lunchable, to raise the dead. Yes, this is our guy. He'll overthrow the Roman government. Just know it. Reestablish Israel as a sovereign nation under God. Today we would call that a Christian nation. And Judas wasn't alone. We still hear those voices today. Pockets of those voices throughout Canada, reverberating north across the border. Was Judas motivated by greed? Maybe. Or more likely by politics. What if Judas didn't betray Jesus for money, but for a cause, a holy cause? Israel restored, Israel sovereign, the filthy Roman foreigners kicked out and expelled, the land reclaimed at last, a holy national agenda, a nation under God. What a great cause! See how seductive that becomes? Because when you believe God is on your side, when you're convinced that your agenda is God's agenda, you'll use any means to reach that end. Blind spots are dangerous. History proves it. Blind spots are not just inconvenient, they're catastrophic. And you might be thinking, well, we're not there though. Like, we can't really betray Jesus. That's already done. And in one sense, that's true. Judas physically betrayed Jesus, handed Jesus over. We can't do that. But the gospel stories aren't museum pieces. They're not static relics of history. Rather, they refuse to let us sit quietly, safely in the audience, like a reel that we're watching, as neutral bystanders. No, that's not why these were written. Rather, they pull us, they draw us into the scene, and they ask us to challenge ourselves. They hold up a mirror. They ask the hard question, what is the lesson of Judas? How might we betray Judas today? It's just easy to write off Judas. Bad guy from the past, betrayed Jesus, bad actor. The question for us is, how do we do that today? Because whenever we betray the cause of Jesus, his values, his character, his way of living in the world, we betray Jesus. We hand over Jesus. We cannot abandon the way of Jesus without abandoning Jesus himself. We cannot abandon the way of Jesus and still be a Jesus follower. It's contradictory. It's irrational. Pastor Brian Zahn says, the means are the end in the process of becoming. In other words, the means becomes the end. Judas said out loud what everyone else wanted, a deliverer who would wage war for peace for Israel by bringing a hammer down on their enemies with epic fury. In his mind, Jesus had every chance, and now it's clear that would never be the kind of liberator that Jesus would be. So in Judas's mind, Jesus had betrayed him. Jesus had betrayed Judas's expectations, so now Judas was going to betray Jesus. He would dispense with the peacemaking and the enemy-loving Jesus. He wanted a warrior who would fight for his cause. Do you remember that third temptation we looked at in week one of Lent? Jesus was tempted to adopt the ways of the world in order to gain power, the power of the world. He was tempted to bow down to the empire's ways to gain rule over the world, to reach a desired ends with the wrong means. Judas is falling for that third temptation. Christians throughout history have fallen for that third temptation. And so with his expectations crushed, he reacted in anger. Disappointment breeds anger. Dashed expectations bring out the worst in us. Numerous studies have identified that crushed expectations are actually the leading cause of why people join terrorist groups, why they support authoritarian regimes who promise power and identity and employment. 2,000 years later, not much has changed. We may have more in common with Judas than we would like to think. But we can't miss one of Mark's key points. And though we like to speculate and join the dots and solve the mysteries and the motives that hold up a mirror to our motives, Mark seems to be less concerned with Judas's motives than his position. And this is the dire warning for us. He is always, in Mark's gospel, Judas, one of the 12. Judas, one of the inner circle. The betrayer originates from Jesus' closest friends. Look what Mark says as we pick up in verse 17. When it was evening, Jesus came with the 12. And when they had taken their places, this is at the Last Supper, we'll look at that next week. When they had taken their places and were eating, Jesus says, truly I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me. And they began to be distressed and to say to him, to one another, surely not I. Isn't that what we'd say? Couldn't be me. Surely I wouldn't do that. He said to them, it is one of the 12, one who is dipping bread into the bowl with me. For the Son of Man goes as it is written of him, but woe to the one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for him not to have been born. Jesus kept the location of the Passover meal a secret, and it was easy to do in Jerusalem on this week, which was packed with pilgrims. In that crowd, it'd be really difficult to locate and find Jesus. It was impossible. And so the betrayal had to be an inside job, had to come from Jesus' inner circle, from a friend, from Judas, one of the 12. For 3 years, Judas had walked with Jesus. 3 years watching these miracles unfold. 3 years of watching compassion touch the untouchable. 3 years of truth that pierced the heart in Jesus' teaching. He'd seen it all. He'd heard it all. He'd lived it all. He was that close. He was soaked in Jesus, and still he missed Jesus. Still he betrayed him, which reminds us of this really hard truth. We can do all the religious things and miss the heart of Jesus. We can think that we're Team Jesus and miss the heart of Jesus, miss the mission of Jesus, miss the way of Jesus. How sobering is that? Evil is blinding. It prevents us from seeing the consequences clearly. I mean, how many stories have you heard of people who underestimate the consequences of a fling, find themselves on a jumbotron, marriage in ashes, a royal prince one minute, disgusting regular dude the next. Mark gives us a glimpse in his gospel of some dramatic symbolism. Look at this. He said to them, "It is one of the 12 who is dipping into the bowl with me." The word bread isn't actually in any of the earliest manuscripts or copies of the gospel. And there is no dipping of bread in first century Passover meal. Dipping of vegetables, dipping of herbs, no dipping of bread. A lot of scholars think that this is likely a bowl for cleansing. They didn't have sinks with running water. There would have been jugs and bowls on the table. They always washed their hands before a meal, but during the Passover meal, they washed their hands twice. In other words, the one who's washed their hands with me shares the cleansing water with me will betray me. The one I will later share the bread of my broken body and the cup of my forgiveness, even with Judas, that is the betrayer. After dinner, Jesus went with the 11 disciples to a garden nearby. It was a garden called Gethsemane. This is what we read. Immediately while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived, and with him there was a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard." So when he came, he went up to him. This is Judas. He says, "Rabbi, teacher." And he kissed him. Then they laid hands on him and arrested him. Judas, who had just washed his hands with Jesus. Perhaps he washed his hands of Jesus. Was that a moment of cleansing? A moment of fellowship? A moment of betrayal foreshadowed? And now in the garden, he steps forward and he betrays him with a kiss. A moment of affection? A moment of betrayal realized. The washing, the kiss, two sacred gestures, two sacred masks turned into instruments of betrayal and a doorway to death. And maybe it seems a bit dramatic for our purposes. Most of our decisions won't end in murder. But Jesus doesn't just represent us individually, although we do need to look inside. We do need to check our blind spots. But we can look at Judas. And we can see the church. The world desperately needs Jesus, desperately needs those who follow the way of Jesus. Jesus the Nazarene, Jesus the crucified one, not Jesus the prize fighter. And as the church, we are Jesus' presence in the world. People gathered for the sake of the world, not for our own self-preservation. And I'm going to invite Robin up to just create some space for us as we sit with this, the sobriety of it, the profundity of it, the mirror of it. But Lent is not about shame, remember. We say that week after week. Lent is not to shame us. It's about sight. It's about exposing the blind spots. It's meant to reveal those, the ones we'd rather ignore. Blind spots are dangerous on the road, as we're driving, and on the journey of faith, individually and collectively as the church, and we ignore them to our peril. If we ignore them long enough, they become deadly. So I just want to invite you to pause and to invite the Holy Spirit just to search you. And consider what Judas asks us. Where do I compromise? Where do I exchange what is right, the Jesus way, for a supposed good end? Pushing my own agenda and opinion, maybe, even a good one, but ignoring others, bullying others, using my authority over others to push my own agenda. Maybe it's staying silent among our friends and family when there's racist or prejudiced jokes being shared. Because, you know, we want to keep the peace, the good end, the peace. So we compromise solidarity with the vulnerable for the sake of peace. What cause or opinion or ideology do I hold that actually is contrary to the Jesus way? We sang this morning, break down the walls of all my tradition. May that be our prayer today. Let's just pause and reflect on those questions. Matthew's telling of the story, he has Jesus saying after Judas has kissed him, "Friend, do what you are here to do. You do what you think is right. I have to do what I know is right." But other ancient manuscript copies say this, "Friend, why are you here?" I like to think that Jesus asked him why, giving him a chance to search his heart. Maybe a chance to reflect on his motives, check his blind spot. Regardless of which one it is, Jesus greets him as friend. A mortal enemy who just handed him over to death, Jesus calls friend. A betrayer, Jesus calls friend. Is anyone beyond being Jesus' friend? No one here, no one online is beyond being called Jesus' friend. Please know that. Jesus calls you friend. And if this is something you want to know more about, you think, yeah, I just want to know more about this Jesus. I may want to follow this Jesus. Please talk to me after. Talk to our prayer team. They'd love to pray with you, chat with you. Johanna's here, one of our pastors. She'd love to chat with you. So our prayer team is here. There's also a prayer gathering that's happening just down the hall and to the right to pray for the end of human trafficking in the world. We as Lakeside have partnered with organizations committed to ending human trafficking, and February 22nd was a day for ending human trafficking, or a prayer to end human trafficking. We couldn't do it on that day, but today, if you're interested, they'll just walk you through a liturgy. You won't be put on the spot, but we'll just gather for a time of prayer there. And now I just love to bless us as we go. So, dear friends, be strong and unshakable, working enthusiastically for Jesus, for you know that nothing you do for Jesus is ever wasted. Oh, go in peace. Go in peace, friends. Have a great Jesus week. Don't forget to check your blind spots.
Thanks for spending time with us today. If this message was helpful to you, please consider passing it on, giving it a like, or supporting our work so we can continue to provide more great content. And if you're looking for a church to call home, whether in person or online, we'd love to connect. Head to lakesidechurch.ca to find out how you can get involved. Thanks again for being with us. We'll see you next time.